Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome back. Ian Happ.
Happ drives one in the air. Left center field. It's got a chance. Grand slam. Grand slam, Ian Happ.
Outfielder for your Chicago Cubs.
This is trouble back toward the wall as Happ on the track makes the catch. Very good play by Ian Happ. That was not a routine play.
Host of the Compound Podcast.
Let's go to the desert island pet peeves. Three pet peeves that wouldn't be on your desert island because you're already stuck on a desert island. When you go to a restaurant and there's a booth-like setting, and there's a couple, and they both sit on the same side of the booth, like, the what worst. In the f*** are you doing?
That blows my mind.
I get so angry. Number two, when someone is in a public setting and they have their phone on speakerphone.
Oh.
It doesn't even actually have to be on speakerphone if they're just loud talking a phone call. But when someone loud talks a phone call or puts it on speakerphone, they have some feel. Just put the phone up to your ear, talk quietly, go into a separate space. I hate it. Number three, deplaning when somebody gets up on the plane that has a seat farther back than you and they run their ass up to try to be the first off the plane. Hey, you chose the seat if it's Southwest, you paid for it if it's not. Just deplane the right way. Don't be a psychopath.
Ian Happ, every Thursday on the Dan Bernstein Show on 670 The Score.
Welcome back.
It was the airing of grievances in part in episode 12 of the Compound Podcast, but those compared to some that were expressed were relatively normal, reasonable, and understandable. Ian Happ is on Twitter at IanHapp_1. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. How are things, Ian?
Going well. Those were some pretty good pet peeves. I was getting a little fired up there, a little passionate. Those things really get to me.
That's good. That comes through the radio. Meanwhile, as we continue to compile the list of things on that's headlined, Dakota Mekis is a total weirdo. He is getting to like hockey goalie status with some of these. And I kid you, people wouldn't believe me. They got to listen for themselves. One of his pet peeves, the first one that he said, is when the volume setting on, say, a car radio is on an odd number instead of an even number. And I thought he's got to be doing a bit right now, but it sounds like this is actually real. That is something that does bother him.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't matter if it's car radio, if it's on like an Alexa or on the TV. It doesn't matter. Wherever it is, he has to change it. And like when I'm driving and he reaches over to change it from, let's say, 17 to 18, I just have given up. I'm like, whatever, go ahead. I can't deal with that.
And you guys enjoyed the golf, too. I know we talked before about the previous charity matchup, but even though it was in the rain, adverse conditions, I thought it was a really good broadcast. And I thought having the guys mic'd up talking about their shots throughout the day was really entertaining. And it seemed you guys agreed in that regard.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. I think getting to watch two professional athletes who were maybe the two best quarterbacks of all time, and then you get to watch them in a different setting and see how nervous those guys actually are. And playing competitive golf is not easy. And for somebody that's done it in front of 40, you know, 50, however many thousand fans that they get at those games, some of those Super Bowl games, it's still when there's nobody watching you or just a camera crew watching you and you're playing golf, it's really nerve-wracking. So I think to see that was absolutely awesome. And I don't know if you saw this on Twitter, but the Obvious Shirts guys, they tweeted at myself and Lester, that it should be me and John versus Kerry Wood and Dempster would be a nice match.
I have that written down, actually. I have that written down, and I'm thinking about it. There's no reason for that not to happen. You could do it for your current charity.
That's what I'm saying. We could do it for charity. I think everybody in that group has a charity or a cause that they would love to play for. I know that there's a bunch of people that would jump on board in Chicago to help sponsor it and see how much money we could raise. So I would love to do it. I think getting it on TV and giving people a little bit of live entertainment would be really fun.
And what's the deal with what was sort of an offhand comment about how many different wraps you guys are making in the kitchen right now? It seems like sort of a default position where, when in doubt, just put things in some sort of wrap, wrap it up, and take bites out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of tortillas in the compound, and the general move, it doesn't matter if it's like breakfast, or so breakfast would be like eggs and lettuce and cheese and whatever. Your lunch is going to be some sort of like hummus base. Some of the guys are lunch meat. I'm not. Mine's more of like a bean burrito wrap. And then dinner, it's like, well, whatever else you have, chicken, avocado, toss it in there, make another wrap. So everything has been put into a tortilla because we've gotten to the point where it maybe all the food isn't very good, but if you put it together, it just seems okay. You lose some of the bad, you take away some of the good, and you end up right in the middle.
Yeah, I just wonder, when does a wrap become a burrito, and when does a burrito become a wrap, and where is the Venn diagram between the two?
Well, I think there's taco on one end of the spectrum and burrito on the other end, and then you have wrap somewhere in the middle there. So, like, wrap is not as full as a burrito.
Okay.
And taco is open.
Okay, we'll take that under advisement. And the important thing is that you survived the pizza incident. And I don't know who's at fault here, because what happened was the order was placed for Sunday pizza. And I assume, I don't know Phoenix pizza all that well, because I know there's Chicago transplants there and plenty of New York transplants. So I don't know if you're getting it in tavern cut or deeper dish or the regular pie slices. But it turns out that the request for extra sauce was misinterpreted as extra sausage. So you actually didn't end up with the meat-free pizza that you needed, which is really just sad for all of us.
Well, I know you wouldn't believe it, but it was Dakota's fault. And
unbelievable.
So usually we get, it's kind of a New York style pizza. It's called Grimaldi's out here. And so they make a pizza that it almost looks kind of like a margarita pizza, but that's how they do their cheese. And so we started to ask for extra sauce and extra cheese on the cheese pizza because it just a little lacking there and it makes it a better experience. So Dakota gets on the phone, says extra sauce and extra cheese. And they think he said extra sausage. So we get there. We get there 5 minutes early, and Dakota walks in and he calls me and says, "Hey, it's not going to be ready until exactly when they said." So I'm sitting out in the car. 5 minutes goes by. He comes walking out with no pizzas. I'm like, "Oh God, what happened?" So he says, tells me what happened, and they take another 10 minutes to make us two extra pizzas. That were the cheese pizzas, and they let us take the sausage home as well. So we went from wanting to have three pizzas and ending up with five. So we had a lot of leftover pizza. So it ended up working out okay. But of course, Dakota was at fault.
Well, that wouldn't surprise. I've told this story before. When I was with my family in Paris, we were getting out. We wanted to just stop into a cafe and grab some water and a quick bite before we started our day. And we get there, and I realized that I had left my windbreaker back at the apartment. So I said, "All right, you order." So my wife just trying out French, and she ordered what she thought was four flat waters, or a quatre au plat. And I get back and I leave and I come back and 5 minutes later, I get back to the table and she's sitting there with the two kids and the table is covered in two dozen fried eggs. And I said,
"That is fantastic."
I said, "What the hell is going on here? What did you do?" And she's just like, "I screwed up." And in her French was, instead of saying quatre au plat or four waters flat, it was interpreted as quatre au plat or four plates of eggs.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, so we end up, and I have to tell you, honestly, the best eggs I've ever had in my life. absolutely these, totally these French it. French farm eggs. I seriously must have sucked down 8 eggs on my own just for the breakfast. Now, we're eating these damn things. If we're paying for them, we're eating them, and we're not going to be jerky Americans and make a scene out of it. So shut up and everybody eat your eggs. And it was phenomenal. But that's the kind of thing you never live down if you screw up something like that.
Yeah, that worked out perfectly. That's why whenever I'm trying to speak another language, I just do a lot of pointing. A lot of pointing. Look at that, whatever that is, give me that.
Yeah, I look at what people are eating, and I was just mentioning it like the previous segment. We were talking about how you always know what to order, and if you see a lot of people enjoying it, it's probably for a reason. So just point at it and say one of those, and I agree. If you're uncertain, it's generally the right idea. Yeah. Now, as we saw Max Scherzer's statement hit last night, I applauded it. I thought that was a phenomenal way of somebody on that executive negotiating committee to basically tell baseball, we're not talking about compensation right now. We have an agreement on that. So what's next? What else do you have? And it seems to me like, and I'm going to remain optimistic, that this is now the beginning. That this is the beginning of substantive negotiations. Now that you guys have had this this sort of public standoff, that I think this is as solid a response as could be expected from your side. What do you think?
Yeah, I think as much as we don't want this to play out in the media, and I think, like I said last week, the best thing for us to do is to send proposals back and forth and announce it when it's done. But it's positive. Any traction on the two sides sending proposals back and forth is positive. And I think that's what the fans should take from this, is that there's conversations happening and we're getting closer to a deal. No matter how far off we are on these proposals from either side, sending them back and forth is getting us closer to a deal. So I think there's nothing but positives coming out of the two sides talking.
How much conversation is going on that's getting to the rank and file at this point, or is it still trust in the reps and in the executive reps? What's the depth of penetration of the communication? Because what we were hearing early on is, because of the timing of this, more players are more aware and engaged and informed than have been in previous types of collective bargaining, just because of what's been going on in off seasons relative to what's happening now.
Yeah, everybody's been really involved. I know that our team's been talking to each other quite a bit, and that's all you can ask for. I think the PA, we do a great job at making sure that you get the opinion of every single person that the PA represents. And that's how we work as a union. As a rep, you go back and you talk to your teams, and you make sure that you're representing the best of what we have to offer, and then take it back to the top, and that's how the decisions are made. So I think the communication has been fantastic, and that's something that we'll continue to strive for, is just making sure that every single person is heard and that we work collectively as a group.
Yeah, I as we mentioned before, I feel for the minor leaguers, because we just have been hearing how different ownerships are taking different approaches to how they're going to be paying some of these guys and how long some of these stipends are going to be available. It does look like one way or another there's going to be a restructuring of the minor leagues and of how these draft picks make their way towards the majors, the number of affiliated teams, maybe opportunities for more independent leagues. As it shakes out, what are people talking about behind the scenes about, and it's very easy to concentrate on the majors, but the business of baseball does rely on development and the feeder system, which you've experienced now. What do you think would be the right way to do it fairly, to make sure that if baseball is streamlining its business in some way, that it doesn't keep the best players from getting opportunities at jobs?
Yeah, I think that it's a very difficult question as far as the minor league structure. And any time that people in our industry are losing jobs, it's not fun. And I know that it's not just players. There's a lot of coaches and staff that make their living that way, that are coaches in some of the lower level systems that they're talking about eliminating. So that part of it, absolutely hate to see. The other side of it is that there are a few different facilities in different cities across the country that are not fit for minor league baseball. You play in places where the field is terrible. There's no hot water in the showers. The locker room is not big enough to accommodate what teams are bringing now. So I think that that'll be a positive outcome if they do decide to shake down the minor league system a little bit, is you'll have better facilities for the players in the minor leagues. And I think that that would be the one positive outcome here. But as far as the actual structure and what the minor leagues are going to look like moving forward, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the plan is. And unfortunately, the MLBPA does not represent minor league players. So it's not something that we're privy to. It's a discussion and negotiation between MLB and minor league baseball directly.
Are you guys getting stir crazy at all? As much fun as you're having down there, and as much as you're staying in shape and you have activities, and I know you're playing golf and playing tennis, but are you getting at all tired of each other?
I think this last week we kind of hit a wall where we were like, you know what, the compound's great, we're having a bunch of fun, but yeah, you walk in the kitchen, you look at the same food again, you kind of have the same three or four activities that you do all the time. And I think that part of it definitely will drive you a little stir crazy, combined with the fact that Arizona has moved to no temperature under 100 degrees for the foreseeable future. So that's a tough combination for making you want to go outside and do a bunch of stuff. But we're happy to be where we are. Arizona has really eased up on a lot of things. So Arizona is a place that is feeling more and more like normal. And I think we're very fortunate for that.
I want to get back to the golf for a second, because I know you're it's always fun to talk about golf with you because of how often you play, you know, your connection to the game growing up, and what it's meant to you. When I started hearing the way Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods were talking about their shots, particularly Mickelson, it just gave me an appreciation for a level of skill, a specificity to which they think about the game that is just remarkable to me. And I know we've heard it before. Broadcasters talk about it all the time. It's different when a broadcaster is talking about it than when you hear a player in the moment kind of feeling his way through it. And even especially in those conditions, you know, I've never thought Phil in interviews is kind of a bland guy. He's got a little bit more interesting as he's gotten older and offered a bit more of himself. But when you play, and you're obviously a low single digit handicap, I think, would you say you're a two or a three? Are you at a level in golf where you are in baseball with how specifically you can think about the shape of a shot, the trajectory of a shot, and looking at a putt, the grain of the grass on the green and things like that? Because I loved hearing all those details.
Yeah, I think I'm in between where your average golfer is and where these guys are. The most impressive part to me is what they can do around the greens, their short game. I don't have the control of my golf ball that they do around the greens. I thought the one shot that Phil hit where he said, I'm going to run this up, it's going to bump, it's going to jump two times and stop right next to the hole. I don't have that ability. If I do, I will imagine that shot in my head. If I pull it off, one every five or one every 10 times, I'm saying, wow, that was pretty good. And I'll surprise myself a little bit, but my iron play is pretty strong. I'm pretty strong off the tee. So I am able to work it and kind of see the shot before I hit it in that sense. And then I think with the putting, the reading of the grain, when I moved to Texas and I spent my off seasons there, there's a lot of grain down in Texas on the Bermuda green. So I've learned a lot about reading the different grain and which way it moves and how it's going to affect your putt and chipping into the grain and against it. Yeah, those are really fun conversations to have. I grew up in the north, grass very similar to what guys plant in Chicago, and it's just lush and green, and you don't really have to worry about any of that stuff. And the bent grass greens are just absolutely perfect. But when you start playing in the south or Florida or Texas, you experience that, and it's a completely different world. And it's fun. It's really fun to learn all those different things and kind of, I've been fortunate enough to play golf all over the country and get to experience that.
When I played in Tucson, I couldn't read a putt. And not that I'm any good to begin with, but the mountain golf, playing some of these mountain courses where you take into effect the that I what my and my dad told me, he says everything comes off the mountain. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, so read this button, tell me what you see. And I said, well, here's what I see. And he says, well, that's not what's going to happen. Watch. And I couldn't adjust to the understanding of the different sort of gravitational vectors that were going in mountain golf. It was just unbelievably frustrating to me.
Yeah, that's how it is in Scottsdale, too, but everything breaks towards the valley. So in Scottsdale, you play all these different courses, and the valley, wherever it is, that's where your putt's going to go. So you read your break, and then you take into account where the valley is, and it completely changes the putt. And it took me a couple years to really kind of figure that one out. But you'll hit a putt that's a little bit downhill and then down valley, and the thing is flying away from you. And you can't stop it. And then you'll hit a putt kind of away from the valley, uphill, and you have to hit it as hard as you possibly can to get it to the hole. So that that's always been a concept that makes absolutely no sense to me, because you feel like the green is pitched directly at you. It's going to be uphill, but, oh, you're down valley, so you don't have to hit it that hard. I've never understood that one either.
So I think this works. I think Ian Happ and John Lester against Kerry Wood and Ryan Dempster. And for you, it could benefit your family foundation and or quarantine coffee at the moment, with $3 from every bag sold going to directly to COVID-19 relief charities. I wonder if we could do this. We could do it some nice course here. Maybe get like Butler National, the Merit Club or something, or Medina, or, you know, we could get a Cog Hill and really set this up for something.
Yeah, I think Rich Harvest Farms is on board to do it. They have a great relationship out there. They're actually going to be a partner with me to auction off a round with Five Iron Golf downtown Chicago to play around with me and bring three guys out and go play around at Rich Harvest with me. We're going to auction that off in a week or two for some COVID charities. So I think they were open to doing it, and there's definitely some partners in the city that would love to sponsor it and be a part of it. So I think it would be absolutely awesome. It would be great to kind of give people that inside look at what a round of golf looks like between the four of us.
Awesome. Let's get on it. And is there any news coming out of Quarantine Coffee?
It's been great. It's been great. The most recent news is we've partnered with Feeding America and the Chicago Food Bank. So that's going to be half of the donation of the $3 per bag, and that's going to provide 4.5 meals for every bag of coffee you buy. So we're so excited about that partnership. They've been a great partner. We're excited to support them and the work that they're doing and making sure people and children are getting fed during this time. I know there's a lot of people out there that don't know where their next meal is coming from. So for us to be able to provide 4.5 meals for every bag of Quarantine Coffee sold, it's so incredible. It's so impressive. And we just appreciate the support that everyone who's going out buying coffee and helping us on this mission of COVID relief.
Outstanding stuff. Ian, continued good health, and here's to negotiations picking up steam and baseball back in the near future.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
That is Ian Happ of the Chicago Cubs, our weekly guest. You can listen to their podcast from The Compound. It is The Compound Podcast. It's an easy listen. It's a half hour. Gets me through cardio exercise every Wednesday, and it's good stuff because they're fun. And Dakota Mekas, you got to get to know him because he is beyond weird, man. He is definitely a thing. We're going to play Who Am I? Because there's somebody who's in the news for an interesting reason, and we haven't done this in a while, so I thought I would do this. What we do is I give you information about an athlete, and you try to figure out who it is, and the texters will usually light everything up with guesses, and then we go into break, and then we come out, and I tell you if you're right or wrong, and then there's a news story connected to this person. So I'm going to ask you, who am I? I am a 7-time All-Star baseball player. I was an MVP 1 year. I was also Rookie of the Year 1 year. I did play at one time for a Chicago team. Here is what is amazing. By the statistic of weighted runs created plus, which is the best single offensive statistic that weights you for how you performed relative to others offensively in the era in which you played, I am 17th all-time with a weighted runs created plus of 155. That means for my career, I was 55% more productive than the average offensive player against whom I played. That number of 155 is higher than the weighted runs created plus of Willie Mays, Frank Thomas, Hank Greenberg, Frank Robinson, Hank Aaron, Manny Ramirez, and Joe DiMaggio. And I am not in the Hall of Fame, despite years of eligibility. Who am I? We'll answer it next on The Score.
Dan Bernstein asks, who am I?
Hair's kind of, I don't know, brown.
Oh, he's tall.
Yeah, he's kind of tall, sort of tall. And he's like always wearing
T-shirts.
Yeah.
Who am I?
So he's sort of tall.
Kind of.
With hair.
Yeah.
And he wears T-shirts sometimes.
Yes.
On 670 The Score.
I asked you the question as we went to break, who am I? Because I saw his name surface in a local news story that should be of interest. And these are some of the bits of information that were provided. I mentioned he did at one point play for a Chicago team. The 7-time All-Star. He was an MVP. He was a Rookie of the Year. And his career slash line, I don't know if I gave you this, but his career slash line is batted .292, on base .378, and slugged .534 at a time when there wasn't a whole lot of slugging. And that bears out in his astonishing weighted runs created plus, which is at 155, 17th all-time, ahead of the same number there of Willie Mays, Frank Thomas, Hank Greenberg, Frank Robinson, Hank Aaron, Manny Ramirez, Joe DiMaggio, etc. And I am speaking of Dick Allen. Dick Allen, who won his MVP in 1972 as a member of the Chicago White Sox, not in the Hall of Fame, remains a hopeful. Say, okay, well, big deal. Why do you bring him up? The reason is Phil Rosenthal of the Chicago Tribune wrote a story a couple days ago that one of the pet projects of Last Dance executive producer Mike Tolan is that he wants to do a documentary on Dick Allen. He says he was a rookie Phillies fan in 1964. That's when Dick Allen was Richie Allen, which he never really liked. That's when he was National League Rookie of the Year. And he said the seed was planted then when he came to the plate at Connie Mack Stadium with that 41-ounce war club and hit balls over the roof. And he said he was entranced by Allen many years ago, and the two have been friends. And he shot material and has been shooting material for the project since 2000. When he was directing and producing the movie Summer Catch. That was Freddie Prinze Jr. and Jessica Biel. I don't know that movie. But he cast Allen in the role Scout in a Black Hat. And then he recorded material while on location in North Carolina. And he says if it comes out, as I hope in the next 2 years, will be right on par with The Last Dance for a 22-year production period. He said, this is my baby. This will be directed, produced, written, and with the money raised by me. I don't know if that last one's a credit, but it's the most important part. Yeah, that's called executive producer, I think, if you're talking where the money is coming from. And I don't know a whole lot. I was just too young to really appreciate Dick Allen as a White Sox or anything else. But the stories are amazing. And people are using modern data to look at how far some of the balls that he hit traveled, where they hit, and how high off the ground they were to actually retroactively figure out some of the distances. And yeah, a 41-ounce bat. He is among those, if I remember correctly, if you remember the old configuration of old Comiskey Park, you know, when the Sox, the winning ugly Sox in 83, they had created that secondary center field fence that there was a shorter and more sort of normalized 401, I think it was 400-401 where those were turned right there. There was a normal center field padded wall. And behind it was the brick wall that had like those like speaker things that were sticking out of it. That used to be the cavernous actual center field. And it was a huge deal when someone would hit it into the batter's eye there, what were at the time seats there. And I remember that even with the actual, with the new wall there, it was the only one I ever saw do it with my own eyes was Tony Armas. When Armas put one in those seats, and it was just like, oh my God, I didn't even think that was possible. Well, apparently, I wouldn't say regularly, but it wasn't really that much of a surprise when Dick Allen used to do that. And prodigious shots, roof shots, and screamers off the roof facade. I'm sure White Sox fans have more visual memories that I can offer here from based anecdotally, but I think this would be great. I would really be down for it because I don't know. I know he was a tremendously controversial player for a lot of reasons, had a lot of racism directed his way and had things thrown at him. He wore his batting helmet in the field because of how often fans threw things, threw batteries at him and threw things at him. And it was just kind of baked in. It's just what he did. He was also incredibly fast, too. I believe he had... No, it's true. He had two inside the park home runs in a single game when he was with the White Sox, both off Burt Blyleven. And that was in part because of the depth of center field and because of those alleys. But he had two inside the park home runs in a single game. Also, he was a talk show host and a singer and, frankly, just deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He deserves to be. He absolutely does. And Mike Tolan says it would be hard to top The Last Dance, according to the Tribune. And he says that The Last Dance recreated something we lost, which is the water cooler culture of getting together Monday morning and talking with everybody about what we've seen the night before. His families watch together each week. I don't know if that would happen with this documentary, but I'm down. Count me in. Next up, we're going to find out what is real, what is not real, and what's good or not about the potential of a return fighting engagement for 53-year-old Mike Tyson. Boxing expert and former Score guy, John Shaky Suntris, will be with us to talk about it next on Sports Radio 670, The Score.
Yeah, I love meeting athletes. Mike Tyson, I love that guy. I love him so much. He's amazing. So I want to... We've been talking together about doing something together.
Like what?
You know,
what are you planning on doing?
You gonna fight him in the ring?
You know, yeah. this business, people are always doing crazy stuff. But I'm so excited about his return. I mean,
you think that's gonna happen?
That's a real thing.
I'm concerned for both of them.
Oh, did they announce who it was?
No. Well, I thought it was going to be Evander Holyfield. That Mike Tyson. They've been talking about Tyson, Evander Holyfield. That's what the rumors have been.
No. I know who it is.
You know who it is. Wait, give us a hint. Let's play mystery guess.
When it's going to be.
Let's play mystery guess with David Arquette.
Let's start with the date, and we'll work backwards. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Look at you dropping info. Look at
that. I know.
So this is really going to happen.
This is called excitement. This is called hype. This is building it all up. Mike Tyson's one of the greatest champions we have, and he's got one more fight in him. And that's what my wrestling sort of return was all about. So I'm behind it 100%.
Does he always sound like that, or is David Arquette just high as balls? Wow. David Arquette on WEEI with Ordway, Merloni, and Foria, attorneys at law. He says it's happening definitely, and he knows who it is. So let's find out more and try to drill to the bottom of just exactly what's happening here with the potential return of 53-year-old Mike Tyson. Joining us is our guy, John Shaky Suntris. You follow him on Twitter at John Word Balloon. He's the man behind the Word Balloon podcast, and he's on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Shaky, what's up, man?
Dan, good to talk to you. Strange times. Not only the pandemic, but the announcement of this comeback.
Yeah, it's not official yet, but I'm wondering, what are we talking about? Are we talking about something that is inevitably going to be a stunt, or are we seeing Mike Tyson at 53 in these short videos that we've seen, in shape, looking, his hands look really quick, he looks menacing, he's pivoting quickly. Could this be something resembling a real heavyweight fight?
It's 50-50, Dan, because until we hear an opponent, I'm intrigued by either the thought of a Tyson exhibition with an Evander Holyfield. These guys are proving that being in your 50s isn't what it was 20 years ago, certainly in our father's times, or even in maybe, my time right now. Currently, I couldn't step in the ring. I'll admit Tyson looks pretty good. He looks like he's about 10 or 15 pounds from ring shape. That said, those clips of him hitting the mitts don't hit back. So, sure, that looks good. And it really looks good for a burst of a nice, 10-second combination. Let's see a full round of sparring. Actually, let's see several rounds of sparring. Because I do think if he's talking about fighting a current heavyweight, he's got a puncher's chance because the punch doesn't leave you. Billy Kahn stopped a Munger when he was 70 because he could still punch like a light heavyweight. So, I mean, literally, the punch doesn't go away. Foreman proved that 25 years ago. When he won the title back and everything. And granted, 48, that's 50, it's 5 years more. But again, I think Tyson looks pretty good for his age. But, yeah, I'd like to see more sparring before I can really judge whether he's ready for a full – I think he could handle an exhibition, and I think he and Holyfield would have a very entertaining exhibition. But if he's talking about fighting a live body and really throwing in, I believe the promotion can happen. But, I mean, you know, outside of a puncher's chance, I mean, he is a 53-year-old man.
Let's stick with the Foreman comp for a moment, because I remember it vividly. I was really into it when Foreman began the comeback, in large part because of his reinvention of himself from sort of this brooding, menacing former street criminal into the smiling, happy uncle, sung to the tune of Shiny Happy People. And then he changed the way he fought, where he created this defense with he knew that, like you say, the punch never left you. The left jab was still quick, and he would cover his face with his arms. He would literally just fold his arms around up in front of his face and say, "You want to punch my arms? You can punch my arms all day." It was a fascinating tactical move on his part. And he graduated from this little 4-round USA Network fights against, you know, Ken LaCosta to going against some real fighters. When and how would we start to realize that Tyson would be similarly dedicated to something more than a one-off payday?
Well, that's the thing. That's a big difference. Foreman needed to get his timing back, and I interviewed him as early as his sixth or eighth fight when he fought the former cruiserweight champion, Dwight Muhammad Cowie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "George, what are you doing, man?"
He said, that was Dwight Braxton, right? Wasn't it initially Dwight Braxton?
Right?
Okay.
Very good. Attaboy, Dan. Absolutely. Before he became a Muslim, he was Dwight Braxton. And one of the best light heavyweights ever and best cruiserweights ever, second only to Michael Spinks at light heavyweight and Holyfield at cruiserweight. So, you know, Foreman knew he needed timing, but like you said, he had to change his style. I really think Tyson has the correct style, and certainly an in-prime Tyson I would love to see fight today's heavyweights. All these big men that, frankly, they don't have the muscle memory to react to a Tyson outburst. And that's why Tyson absolutely has a puncher's chance, and I'm impressed enough to see all that in these limited bursts of, exhibition or sparring that we've seen, or him hitting the bag. Don't forget, Conor McGregor looked adequate hitting the bags as he prepared to fight Floyd Mayweather, and then we saw how inadequate he was when the fight actually happened. But again, Tyson has the muscle memory that I think a lot of these newer heavyweights, where boxing is the second sport that came to them late in their athletic careers, literally in some cases in their 20s before they started. So, I mean, I would love to see a prime Mike Tyson fight a prime Deontay Wilder. He'd kill him. He'd kill him. And even a 53-year-old Tyson, given Wilder's lack of defensive skills, that would be a very interesting 3 minutes. And I think it's in anybody's fight because you got two powerhouse punchers. And I do still think that Tyson clearly has not only the punching power, but the pinpoint accuracy of where to make these things hurt. That's what Customato and Kevin Rooney taught Tyson very well, and Teddy Atlas for that matter.
This is really interesting that you're giving this a little bit more credence about the potential quality of Tyson as a fighter than maybe I thought. And when you talk about these larger, rangier heavyweights, I always remember how Tyson could make a joke out of the reach comparison when they'd always look at arm's length and how they would define the proximities. I'm like, look, this guy wants to fight you in a phone booth, and yep. how he could, from the inside, and even more so than Frazier did, be able in a compact situation to generate incredible force over a very short area, a very short distance of punch because of the acceleration of the force. Do you think he still has that ability to get the fist to full speed over that short an area?
The fists, yes. The legs are the question, though, Dan, because, again, Tyson's footwork and his ability to literally be like a piston and really, like, get in a crouch and pop up with combinations. Let's see how those 53-year-old legs are. And that's why I really want to see him spar with a live target. I mean, you know, when he was in his prime, he was fighting former heavyweight champions like Greg Page as sparring partners and stuff, because Page was a cagey fighter. And that's what we really need to see to judge what a 53-year-old Mike Tyson looks like. But again, puncher's chance, absolutely. And the fact that these giant opponents, as big as they are, they don't have sure footing. That is why Andy Ruiz was able to make a joke out of Anthony Joshua the first time. And a lot of these guys, I think they, honestly, it's kind of crazy, But I think these guys would take a 20-year older Tyson seriously because of that threat of a puncher's thing. I mean, we've seen the rumor that, you know, Tyson Fury was approached supposedly. I don't believe that. And if I were Fury, I'd stay away from it just because he's doing great. I mean, Tyson Fury's doing fine. But it would be interesting. And, I mean, I really think that the top 10 heavyweights would likely obviously have a very easy time with Tyson. But there's a lot of ham and eggers out there. Like you said, is it coming back for one fight or and one big payday, which I'm sure he could use given his issues with the IRS, which he's trying to obviously fix. But or is he like a Foreman where it would be a series of fights? He can certainly set up enough fights with some ham and eggers, to use the old phrase, to make it interesting and generate a lot of money because he's still a spectacle and people still want to see him. So he can be properly matched if he's really serious about a several-fight comeback.
I brought it up the other day, too, that where we live in the post-Me Too era, it's one thing for some of these cretins like Matt Lauer or Harvey Weinstein. It's another when we're literally talking about a convicted rapist who served half of his sentence before being paroled, and yet somehow we've all agreed, everybody involved has kind of agreed that we're not really discussing that or talking about that or saying, is this okay? Is in especially in this day and age with a greater sensitivity and understanding of some of these things, has he ever expressed remorse or genuine guilt for this, or is that still kind of a gray area? Because that makes me a little queasy when we think about it.
I understand, but he did serve his time, Dan. And is it, I mean, by the way, it's boxing. I mean, it's not,
right.
We're not talking about, Major League Baseball or one of the big four or something like that. Boxing's already a dirty sport. We've had Sonny Liston, a former mob enforcer, leg breaker, several fighters that did time both before and after. Tony Ayala, the great junior middleweight, was also a convicted rapist, went in. Came back and did have some comeback fights, was never the same fighter. So I do believe it's the Nixon effect that if you actually, well, Nixon never was served any time. But I also think that, there'll be protesters. I mean, there were when Tyson got out and immediately, and you're right, in this Me Too era, it's fair to complain about that. But again, it's boxing. And I think the people that will be complaining likely wouldn't be the pay-per-view people that'd be coming on. Again, you've got clowns like Conor McGregor that are an embarrassment in the ring. And let's not forget not only the rape, but Tyson biting Holyfield's ear off. I mean, that was my breaking point with Tyson where I was like, okay. But I also think he is older. I do think that he is trying to do the right thing. I think he has been trying to comport himself as a decent enough citizen. And, I'll tell you, he's got a cartoon on Cartoon Network. So I don't hear the Me Too people complaining about that show. So it's an interesting question.
We're talking with John Suntress, a boxing historian here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. I'll admit, part of me wanted you to talk me out of being interested in this. I'll admit it. I wanted you to say, oh, stop it. This is ridiculous. It's a stunt. He's an old man. This can't happen. Because now the door's open again. And now I'm going to be disappointed again when it does turn out to be a clown show or just some kind of silly exhibition. I would love to have the sports story of a rededicated, reinvented Mike Tyson getting back at it. And you've left the door open, John.
Well, Dan, honestly, the easy argument is to go with the obvious. He's too old. This is silly and all that stuff. But it's boxing, and boxing. God, Jack Dempsey fought Cowboy Luttrell, Bob Luttrell's dad, in the late 40s, 20 years after his prime. And they met in a boxing ring, and Dempsey was so embarrassed by his man boobs, he actually wore a T-shirt in the ring, and he beat the hell out of Cowboy Luttrell. And it was partially a little wrestling thing, but he was definitely punching him, and he could still punch. So I always think that boxing has that sideshow thing that you never say never. And also, God, Bernard Hopkins fought till he was 50 and was fighting top contenders, and like we said, with George Foreman and stuff. So it's not impossible. But, the easy argument is no way. But so it is interesting to say, well, let's not forget puncher seems to be rededicated. We'll see.
An actual puncher's chance, and we're not using it as a euphemism. We actually meet it this time.
Yep.
John, thank you. Appreciate it, man. Be well.
Always a pleasure, Dan. Thanks a lot.
That is John Suntress. Well, there it is. I was expecting him to say uh-uh, and he didn't. So we thank John for joining us today. We also thank Brian Geltzeiler and Eugene Friedman and Ian Happ for being a part of the show as well. Lawrence Holmes is coming your way next. He's got Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo joining him at 1 o'clock today. And thanks to Jay Zawoski. Thanks to Ray Diaz. Be back for a Friday show tomorrow. Keep doing what you're doing. It's working. The numbers are trending in a good direction. So don't stop now, boys. Keep washing your hands. Keep wiping things down. Keep staying away from people as best you can with proper social distancing. If you're out of the house and indoors in a public area, you got to wear a mask. Do that. Wear it over your nose and mouth. Otherwise, you're not wearing one. So remember, it's doing that isn't necessarily for you. It's for everybody else. And it's just a simple way to show that you care about other people. And caring about other people is a good thing, not a bad thing. Listen to doctors and only listen to people who listen to doctors. It's already Friday tomorrow, so we'll talk to you then.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.